Amen. If you have Bibles with you, if you could open it to 1 Peter. If you have phones with you and you have a Bible on your phone, you can do that. No checking Facebook on your phone, though. That's not the same thing. I've taught enough to know how that works. You know, this passage in 1 Peter is it's an amazing passage because he talks about this wonderful thing in verses 9 and 10. You know, you're a chosen people, a royal priesthood. This is 1 Peter chapter 2, down in verse 9. Chosen people, royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people belonging to God. You weren't, and now you are. It's this wonderful thing. You've received mercy. You're special. And then verse 11, it kind of takes a shift. And it says, "Dear friends, I urge you as aliens and strangers." So you are a royal priesthood, and you're really strange. In fact, you're an alien. These words, alien and stranger, are really interesting words. They show up a couple places in 1 Peter, and they're translated, depending on which translation you look at, really synonymously. In 1:1, it shows up, and they're called strangers, sojourners, pilgrims, aliens. In 1:17, the other word shows up, and again, depending on the translation, sojourners, strangers, aliens. Up in this 1:1, in the very beginning of Peter, he's actually tapping into what was a reality of the day. Some of you have heard the word the diaspora. The Jews were literally spread all over the world. There were like 1 million Jews living in the Holy Land, and there were over 4 million Jews by estimation living all over the world. And so they were called the Jews who were scattered. They were strangers in the land they went to. They retained their Jewishness. They retained their day of worship and their Sabbath and their food and their behavior, but they lived in a different culture. And Peter, who in many ways was an apostle to the Jews, is now applying that same concept to the whole church. It's fascinating because he's saying to the church, these are no longer the Jews he's speaking to, if you follow 1 Peter carefully, but to all believers, all Christians who were in the world, they were part of the kingdom of darkness. And the gospel says that we were transferred from the kingdom of darkness into the kingdom of his dear son. And so he says, now that you're into this new kingdom, but you're still living in the realm of the old kingdom, you're strangers. You're scattered. You're sojourners. And he uses that word, diaspora. You are now the diaspora of God's people. It's a fascinating concept that where we live is not our home. And we know that, and yet, I don't know about you, but I need to be reminded of it. I mean, I tend to think when I travel overseas, I go to, you know, cross-cultural. But according to 1 Peter, if you're a believer, you're living cross-cultural right now. Because the culture of this world is the one you are in, but the culture of this world is not the one you're to be of. In the world, but not of the world. This concept is a concept that was used of Abraham in Genesis 33. It was used in Psalm 39:12. It's used in Hebrews. It flows throughout the whole scriptures that God's people are a unique people called out from among those that they live amidst. And interestingly, in all of these words and trying to fit them together, in 1981, a theologian by the name of J.H. Eliot came up with the term resident alien. Now, he didn't come up with that term, but he applied it here. And most commentators have pulled on that concept of resident alien as a real good translation for these two words, that we, as believers in Jesus Christ, have become resident aliens where we live. Now, for Peter, they were resident aliens because they were suffering. the fact that they had become Christians was causing suffering for many, many, many of them. In fact, 1 Peter is considered the gospel to the suffering. And it's because of the 16 times the word suffer shows up as a noun, four of them are in 1 Peter. Of the 41 times that suffering as a verb shows up, 12 of them show up in 1 Peter. So, you know, the book I have here in front of you is just a New Testament. It's two different translations, and then it's the Greek, and then a transliteration. And this much of it is 1 Peter. And a quarter of the time that the word suffering as a verb or a noun shows up in these pages compared to the rest. Peter is reminding folks that as a resident alien, don't be surprised that you suffer. Because you're in the world, but you are not of it. You are radically different. So I'd like to take this concept, resident alien, and explore it a little with you. And then, since it's St. Patrick's Day, I thought I would share a little bit about Patrick's history, because he's a great example of resident alien as it applies to us. So a resident alien is a foreign national living on an official basis in a country of which they are not a citizen. In other words, when a resident alien lives somewhere, their identity remains back with the host country, and yet their primary task is in their new country. So if you are an ambassador, you remain an American, you continue to dress like an American, you continue to eat like an American, you continue to act like an American. But if you are living in China as an ambassador, your primary task is that of ambassador to this country, representing the country from which you are to the country you've come to. Same is true if you're a business person. You're representing, and in this context, it's not your country, but it's your company. And it's your international company, but you come from maybe somewhere else, and now you've moved here, and so your identity is with that company, but your task is with that new location. And so the transfer for us is profound, because folks, our primary identity is the beloved of God. Our primary identity is a child of God. God has redeemed you. You're a royal priesthood, a holy nation, all of those wonderful things. But our primary task is in the place that we're not at home. Right here. Wherever we are. As a resident, you are not a tourist. I'm sorry. Yeah, you're not a tourist, but a resident. You set up an apartment, begin a job, you make friends, you relate with new neighbors. Now, I'd like to talk a little bit about cultural learning, because there's a kind of a cultural learning curve that I think applies to Patrick in particular and us as well. In cultural learning, the first step of cultural learning is you don't know what you don't know. I'll give you a real good example. So I've eaten a lot of curried chicken in Nepal. I mean, I've eaten a lot of curried chicken in Nepal. And I would never be so crass as to complain about the curried chicken that I'm served in Nepal unless I'm speaking to my American friends, who all commiserate with me because when they make their curried chicken, they take their chicken bones and they take a really sharp knife and they cut them into little pieces. And so the chicken and the bone are in these tiny little pieces thrown in with the vegetables and the curry and the sauce and all cooked up. And then you pour that over top of the rice. And as you eat it, do you know how hard it is to eat around a bone that's that big? And when you chop those bones, you get little slivers of bone, little pieces of bone. And so you're eating it and you're constantly like, you know? And often, the Nepali people would look at me and say, you like boneless chicken, don't you? Yeah. But I've had that conversation, I don't know, 20, 30 times. But it wasn't until I was on a hike I had a few days off in Nepal, and I got to trek into the Himalayas, and I had a Nepali guide, and it was just him and I, and we went to this, they called it a restaurant, you guys would call it a shack. But they serve us this wonderful curry chicken dinner and, you know, all these little pieces. And we're finishing our meal, and I have a little pile of probably 20 little pieces of chicken bones sitting that I've eaten the, you know, what I can get off of it around. And they never use their fingers like that. I mean, they might pick it up like this, but they don't pull out. And he says, "You like boneless chicken, don't you?" And I said, "Well, actually, I don't mind boned chicken. I just like it on the whole bone because it's easier to eat around." And as I'm saying that, I'm looking at his plate, and I said, "Where are your bones?" He's like, "What are you talking about?" And then it dawned on me. You know where I'm going with this? He ate the bones. And I said, "You mean you eat those?" And he picked one up off of my plate, put it in his mouth, and swallowed it. Classic case of don't know what you don't know. I thought I knew what he meant by boneless chicken. Yes, I like boneless chicken. And I would bet all of you will only eat at this point in your life boneless chicken, as in Nepali understands it. Okay, so don't know what you don't know. Then you get to a place where you know what you don't know. So you realize there are cultural things that you don't quite get. And you know something's going on, but you're not sure what it is that's going on, but you know that you're missing it. And then you get to a place where you actually know what you know, but you have to be real intentional about what you do with what you know that you know, because it's not integrated. One of my favorite examples is in India and Nepal. This means yes. And so I'd be talking to someone, and they'd be doing this. And I'm thinking, oh, I got to convince them more. And then they'd be doing this even more, you know? Because for us, to move your head like this means no. But for them, it's like, oh, I agree with you. And now I understand it. I see it, and I get it, and I understand it. But I have to tell you, when I first see someone do that, I don't immediately jump to, oh, they're agreeing with me. I know what I know, but it's not yet integrated. Is this making sense? And then you get to a place where you don't know what you know. You guys have all kinds of stuff like that in your context. If you don't think so, just go violate some of the things that you do on a regular basis. Next time you eat a piece of pie at a restaurant, don't eat it from the point back. Turn it sideways so you're eating from the corner of the crust across the pie. And watch the people at your table look at you like you're really weird. Or next time you go into an elevator where there are several people, just walk into the elevator and don't turn around and stare at that door. I mean, there's all kinds of things like this that we do. In Nepal, they eat with a fork and a spoon, not a fork and a knife. And so they cut with the spoon, they poke with the fork, they cut with the spoon, they push with the fork into the spoon and eat. And I finally converted because it works really well. And I guess particularly if you're eating the chicken bones that are already all cut up, it's no problem, just right onto that spoon. You don't have to try to cut around anything. So there are all of these cultural things. Let me see if I can illustrate this for you a little bit more. And I got permission from my pastor to use a little potty humor here. So we all know what that is. It's a Western toilet. In many places in the East, that is an Eastern toilet. And I got to tell you, if you're not used to using one of those, it is a learned skill. And in fact, a little instruction doesn't hurt. Now, I don't know if you can read this, but down here, I learned this one the hard way. Suggestion: roll up pants if necessary. Yeah, you only make that mistake once, let me tell you. Then you do know what you know, and it's integrated. Here they suggest, master the squat before you go. You know, little kids from early on, they squat down with their heels on the ground. I'm holding on here because I can't balance without it. My legs aren't strong enough. But have you ever seen a little kid just kind of sit there and squat in the room and look at you? I mean, I call that exercise. I do that and my legs ache. In fact, Jay and I go and do it every Monday, Wednesday, and you know, I'm getting down there on my squats. By the way, Jay just does this. Calls out a squat, you know. Jay, you need to get back to your Indie and get ready, you know. But the other issue with this is, unless you master that squat, my heels come up. And when your heels come up, what happens? You lean forward. Now, if the goal is to make it into that toilet without hitting your pants, leaning forward is a problem. They have a little piece over here because you don't throw the toilet paper into an Eastern toilet. You throw the toilet paper into a basket. By the way, in the Eastern toilet, there is the place where your toilet paper goes. And this one is to do your flushing. And quite frankly, this was in the base in Polker where we taught one of the days. I'm not quite sure why they have that there. Jay, do you know why they have that there?
I'll tell you later.
Okay. Thank you. But just as an example, you don't know what you don't know. Notice that there's one of those baskets over there too. Because just because you have a Western toilet does not mean you have a Western plumbing system. It also does not mean that you have Western-style toilet paper that is designed to dissolve with so much water. And I got to tell you, that's one of those, I know that I know, but it's like, oops, I shouldn't have done that. Because when you drop toilet paper 10,000 times in your life, it becomes a habit. Okay, enough about that. There are some places where they've actually gone Western, and so this was in Nepal, in a airport, and they're telling people, no, our plumbing system is good, so please throw toilet paper in the toilet. Because if you have a toilet that works, you prefer not to have to clean out the garbage can. But I don't understand why, but apparently someone decided they needed a sign that said, but don't throw the whole roll of toilet paper into the toilet. So we can talk about where the toilet paper goes, but the bigger question is, where does it come from? Because do you notice what's missing in this toilet? There's no toilet paper. And there are ways to deal with it, and I know your Western mind is thinking, no, I don't want to use that towel, and they don't want you to use the towel either. That's not the solution, but I'll let you think about that. But there are a number of cases, so if there is no toilet paper, but here again, almost all these pictures I've taken, what if the toilet paper is actually 4.5 feet away and you don't realize it until after you sit down? Or what if you're in a hotel that wants to be Western, and so they hang the toilet paper, but unfortunately they hang it on the wrong side of the shower curtain? That's a challenge. Or maybe they hang it on the outside. And so here again, that's one of the things you don't know that you don't know until you're in, and then you go, oh, now I know why that was out there before I walked into the stall. And then in Ecuador, they just take care of it for you. The taxis are installed with toilet paper before you get out of the taxi for wherever it is you're going. Wonderful gift. I think that's because it's a tipping industry. In Japan, I don't have to spend much time here. They're very Westernized. They actually have little design, no toilet paper. They just solve the whole problem. They have jets and sprays. And actually, this one's like a high-tech spray. I don't know why you would need pulsating water jets. But you can adjust the position of the nozzle. Male, female, there is a difference. You can adjust the power. I think Tim, the tool man, Taylor, did that. But back to where I'm in the more of the underdeveloped nations. And the question here becomes, they have to learn how to use a Western toilet if you're from an Eastern toilet. And so if you're a guy, you kind of get this picture. And then this next picture is my absolute favorite because it's educational, because you don't know what you don't know until you do something wrong. So a clear instruction of what not to do and what to do if you're now at a Western toilet. My last ones, and then I'll get on to my message, forgive me, but I couldn't resist. So in Polkra, it is now becoming a very touristy area. Up until like 10 years ago, Westerners weren't allowed in. I mean, it was hard to get in. Very difficult. Now it's very easy. You pay some money and you can get a visa right there. And Polk is one of their major spots. They have a beautiful lake. They have beautiful mountains. The mountains are really close. And so some entrepreneur has decided that what they could never sell to Nepalese, they can now sell to Westerners who come. And so there is a fee for using the bathroom. I'm not quite sure why. You can't see this very well, but longs cost 10 and shorts cost 5. Yeah, I don't know what a long and a short is either. I have some guesses. Quite frankly, my Nepali friend wasn't sure what a long or a short was. But what really confused me was the women's, their longs cost 9 times as much and their shorts are half as much. Well, back to our message. So, you're a resident, but you're also an alien. You're also an alien. That means you're one of many foreigners. It means your citizenship is somewhere else. It means that your home is a relative term. And it means that you are now displaced for the purpose of a mission. Again, your primary identity is connected to where your true home is. For us as Christians, it's in the heart of God. But your primary task is related to where he has placed you on behalf of your primary identity, which is in the heart of God. I'm here for a purpose. I'm here for a reason. Which leads us to St. Patrick. St. Patrick, when he lived in Britain, England area, and when he was 16 years old, some Celtic pirates came and they kidnapped him, took him and sold him to a Druid chief, and he became a slave for the next 6 years of his life. Now, remember when I talked about the, you don't know what you don't know what you don't know what you know, and then don't know what you know, that fully integrated? I heard a missiologist say it typically takes about a decade to kind of get to that integrated part for people, unless you are in full immersion. If you're fully immersed, where you have no choice but to speak the language, no choice but to learn the ways of the people that you live with, that process can be speeded up. And so Patrick was there by himself, fully among these Celtic overlords, and was forced to really learn about the Celtic context. Now, when you are in a context like that, and it was the point of Peter talking about suffering and talking about being the chosen of God, but also talking about being resident aliens, in that context, it tends to do one of two things to us, folks. When you suffer greatly, it does one of two things. It either drives you from God, or it drives you to God. And for Patrick, in his own journals, he writes that while he lived among the Celts for 16 years, he was driven to pray 100 times a day. Some of the greatest missions experience that he possibly could have had was being forced to pray. I remember 10, 15 years ago, we were coming up with a missionary development program for missionaries in the Brethren in Christ. And an older lady came up to me. She had been retired from missions for more than a decade. And she was saying how pleased she was that we were doing all this for our missionaries to prepare them. She said, we really didn't have any kind of prep back in my day. All we had was we got on a boat, and we had nothing to do for 3 months while the boat went across the ocean. And so we prayed. But it sure did help when we landed on the ground there. I wonder sometimes if maybe we should stop flying our missionaries over for their first term of service and put them on a boat and take 3 months with nothing to do but pray. Patrick had nothing to do but pray for 6 years as he worked as a slave for the Celtic people. Then he had a dream from God. He was 24 years old, and this dream came to him. And in the dream, it said, "You are going home. Look, your ship is ready." The next morning, he got up, and he left the place where he was supposed to be, which could have been a major disaster had he not gotten off, walked down to the coast, literally saw the ship that he had seen in his dream, walked over, negotiated his opportunity onto the ship, and crossed back over to his home. For the next 25 years, we know very little about Patrick. We do know that he trained for the ministry. Some people think he trained in Gaul. Some people think he trained in Britain. Some people think he went to Rome and trained. We don't know, but he did train. He focused on ministry. He had been radically converted. He had been radically turned on for Jesus Christ. And he said, "I needed to be trained." And so by 25 years later, he is now a full-fledged priest. This is like 300-400s, we're talking, 4th century. And then at age 48, he gets a call to ministry. I'm glad that you shared with us that you're 77 years old, because I was going to ask if there was anyone here who was 77 or older, but then I thought, you know, I probably shouldn't do that because someone's going to be upset that I asked and that they had to raise their hand. So you'll become my illustration. The reason I'm mentioning this is 77, 78 right now is about the average life expectancy of a male in the United States of America. For 4th and 5th century England, Ireland, average life expectancy was under 48 years of age. So Patrick is getting his call to do missionary service at the time at which he is beyond his average life expectancy. So if you're 77 years or older, and you hear a call from God to do something radical and new and fresh, you are right in line with Patrick. Just saying. Now, where he was called, he actually had a dream, and in his dream, the angel Victor came with letters from the people from Ireland, and one of the letters that the angel read to him in this dream was from the people of the Celts, saying, "We appeal to you, holy servant boy, to come walk among us." So he went to the bishop, asked if he could in fact do that. The bishop took it up to the Pope, and it was fascinating because from the 2nd century on, nobody had gone to the barbarians to reach him. Because back in those days, they assumed that you had to civilize people before you could Christianize people. And the Celts couldn't read or write. They were called barbarians, and you know where the word barbarian came from, right? When they would speak, everyone would hear bar, 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 bar. And so they called them barbarians. They're people who just babble on. We can't understand a word they're saying. They were fierce warriors, but when they would go into battle, they would strip down naked, and all they would wear was a sword, a shield, a gold chain, and a thong, and the thong was on her feet, nowhere else. And howling across the field, they would be screaming and running, and as they would capture enemies, they would decapitate them or keep them from human sacrifice. So the Romans concluded, they're unwinnable. They're barbarians. I mean, I don't even know what it would be to civilize them, let alone Christianize them. They can't even read or write. What can we do with them? Patrick said, "I feel called." And so they told Patrick, okay. And they ordained him a bishop. And he went back to Ireland. What's fascinating, well, I could say more about this, but for time, I'll skip it. When I say he focused on the excluded middle, he focused on how God impacts the real things of your life, not just the big heavenly things, or not just finding scientific ways to solve problems down here, but that God actually makes a difference. One of his stories was he went and he blessed the river and prayed for more fish, and the village caught more fish, and so they were receptive to the gospel, and the whole village became Christian. By the way, I've heard my son tell the story at least a dozen times. Between the ages of 8 and 12, Greg Smith would take all the boys of the church fishing one at a time. And he would use it because he liked to fish and liked to have someone with him when he was fishing, but he also used it as kind of discipleship for the boys. He'd talk about Jesus, and he loved going with Josiah because all the other boys, after an hour, if they didn't catch anything, they'd start whining. And Josiah didn't care if it was raining, if they weren't catching. I mean, he wanted to catch, but if he was out there fishing, he was happy. So Greg loved taking them. But Josiah tells a story. Every time we'd go fishing, Greg would pray that they'd catch fish. And he said, every time we'd go, we'd catch fish. Until this one day, they went out to catch fish, and they were out there for about 5 hours, and Greg had to come back in, and they got skunked. Greg docked the boat. He had an appointment to go to. And all of a sudden, Josiah said, "You know, Greg, we didn't pray." And Greg said, "Oh, my. Well, we're going to pray." And so they prayed. He called up, canceled his appointment. They got back in the boat. They went back out. In an hour, they caught their limit. I've heard Josiah tell that story 12 times. Do you think that impacted his faith? Patrick focused on the simple things of life. For him, it was important that you just belong. Radical hospitality. They welcomed people in who were a mess. Yeah, they acted like barbarians. And it was okay. You can come among us. We welcome you. And as you live among us, as we welcome you into our community, you begin to see how we live, and you find, wow, this stuff makes sense. I think I believe it. And then the call was to then become. The call was to discipleship. The call was not to conversion. The call was to commitment. The call was to lordship. Radical approach. In 28 years, depending on who you read, he planted somewhere between 55 and 700 churches. 28 years. Past the age of normal life expectancy. In a culture that was not his own. They say he ordained over 1,000 priests. A lot of mission fields, it takes them 2 decades to think anybody qualified to be a priest or a pastor or a leader. And yet he found ways to give away the gospel. Of the 150 tribes, none of which were Christian, by the time he was done, 40 of them were predominantly Christian. Phenomenal impact. In fact, the impact was so powerful that after his death, the movement continued, and some will say that Patrick's movement actually re-Christianized the main continent because it had gotten so wayward, it had gotten so political, it had gotten so focused on me, what I get, what's the politics of it, rather than who is Jesus and the difference Jesus makes. So I'm almost done here because I want to make a really critical point. One of the reasons why Patrick was so effective when he went was because he was already down here by the time he went. He knew the Celtic language. He knew the Celtic culture. He could fit in it very easily. But he also knew that he was a Christian. And that as a Christian, he would live very different. And so there were things that he would embrace, and there were things he would say no to. He was fully culturized to the kingdom of God because he gave himself 25 years of training, but he was fully culturized to the Celtic people because he understood their culture. And because of that, he was incredibly effective. Why is that important? Because the scriptures say, beloved, remember, you don't belong to this world. You are resident aliens living in exile. Do you know what's fascinating? That you actually are just like Patrick. Many of you have spent decades learning about Jesus, reading the scriptures, attending church, fellowshipping with believers, going to classes, learning what it means to be a Christian, practicing what it means to be a Christian, trying to apply what it means to be a Christian. But you've also lived decades in this world that is not ours. Just like Patrick really understood the Celtic, you understand Ashland. You get it. You can actually fit in Ashland without being too weird. But remember that you are strangers. You are aliens. The word that's used there for both words is it starts with the preface para, and para both means alongside, but it also means abnormal. It's where we get paramedic, the person who comes alongside a medic and does medical stuff. It's also where we get the word abnormal, paranormal. And that's why the word stranger fits so well. You're different. And yet you belong. You're doing. Christians dwell, and this is written in the second century. Christians dwell in their own countries, but only as sojourners. They bear their share in all things as citizens. And they endure all hardships as strangers. Every foreign country is a fatherland to them, and every fatherland is foreign. You're living as a resident alien, whether you're on the other side of the world or the other side of the street. Resident aliens are willing to leave the comforts of home for the mission of God. See, that's the call to us. And I don't mean going to Nepal, but the comforts of even where you are here, while you minister here. Resident aliens are willing to experience culture shock for the mission of God. And I promise you, there are some places in Ashland that if you would go, you would experience a little culture shock. Maybe it's okay to go. Maybe we're called to go. We're definitely called to be willing to go. Resident aliens are willing to experience voluntary displacement for the mission of God. Because while our primary identity is the beloved of God, our primary task is in the place where he has planted us. And resident aliens are willing to relate to people who are unlike us for the mission of God. Because as Jesus said, as you have sent me into the world, I have sent them into the world. Jesus is the quintessential resident alien here on earth. His home was heaven. He was so wholly other than us, and yet he became one of us. He became man that he might win man to God. Or shall I say human, because it's not gender specific. He became human that he might win humans. He is a quintessential resident alien. And so too, beloved, remember, you don't belong to this world. You don't belong here. You have another home. But you are here. You're here with a task and a mission as a resident alien here in Ashland. I welcome you into your calling. Come and lead us in our last song.
And I would invite